to vote in these elections and help us get Pacifica focused on its mission. I'm Bill Crozier, and I thank you for supporting KPFT, our station for peace.
To hear all the candidates' statements and read their plans to help KPFT, please visit elections.pacifica.org. Click on the Station tab and scroll down to find the official election page for your KPFT Houston station.
This is 90.1 KPFT FM, Houston.
Listeners should be aware that the following program contains language and audio images which may be found disturbing and may not be suitable for your snotty-nosed little brat who probably cusses like a sailor behind your back anyway. Parental discretion is advised.
Flying in missing geek formation, this is Technology Bites.
Is that what we're doing?
Flicted's impersonations are getting better and better.
No Flicted, no Peter.
Wow, so yeah. Whoa. Flicted reported via text message that he was running late or maybe cutting it close. Well, he's
smiley
officially...
Smiley face.
He's smiley face, yes. I may not be there on time, more or less. Ah, Gesundheit, bless you.
Sneezes all around.
Excuse me.
All right.
It's all the heavy metals from all that Soylent greeny drink.
Oh, yeah.
Catching
yes, that's what I do.
It's the new apple chew.
That's all I do for
You're not sick, are you?
Like in the head?
Well, no, just are you exhibiting any physical symptoms?
I mean, like more than usual?
He comes in here,
spreads
gets geek dust all over himself, and... responds accordingly.
It's glorious. Start sneezing and everything. Joyous.
All right. Welcome to the show. This is Technology Bites. I'm Jay Lee.
I'm Barrett.
I guess I'm Lee.
And he's
Groovehouse
in charge
for about five more seconds.
Oh, is he driving up now?
He's walking in.
So he can.
Should we let him in?
Long live the king.
It's too late now.
You know he's. Oh, he isn't here isn't... yet.
Lights
in
out.
Mode. Who can grin like a Cheshire cat?
Can. Just don't know how well it's going to show up. Yeah, we came into the studio and someone had messed up all the lights.
I think
apparently
someone was interrogating
blinding.
Someone in here. The
apparently when we upped our signal strength to a full 100,000 watts, the max allowable by the FCC, they interpreted that into 100,000 watt light bulbs.
Yes.
So there are some very bright lights in the studio tonight. And, you know, personally, as Bill Hicks said, I don't really have that kind of complexion. I have a barroom complexion, tan teeth and white skin.
You.
So I don't need these harsh lights showing on me. So, all right. So welcome to the show. We're glad you could tune in. We're glad Flicted could finally make it. We'll see if he's rebooted his computer and whether or not we're going to have Peter Hughes with us tonight. I know Peter Hughes is champing at the bit because, or chafing at the bit.
Chomping at the bit.
No, it's champing. It's champing at the bit.
All right. I don't want to have that mistake again.
Who put a bit in Peter?
Champing at the bit.
So he, so I know that he's champing at the bit to talk about all the Apple news. There's a big news.
Oh no, is
Apple.
Your keyboard going to make that noise all night long?
Oh yes.
Oh, it's backlit.
Hi guys. Oh yeah, bro, I finally got a backlit keyboard.
It's an unearthly green backlight.
Yes, Barrett was explaining that his laptop keyboard has bitten the dust, but the laptop is still functional, so he's got a Gigantor, what is that, a Razer? Razer gaming keyboard?
It's a Razer Black Widow.
A Razer Black Widow gaming keyboard.
There's
with
a warning symbol on the back.
With what sounds like Cherry MX blue or brown switches. They're very loud. Yep.
Yes.
Awesome. So we'll be hearing that all night. So now you'll get to hear when you get to hear when Barrett Googles. Barrett Googling.
Huh. All right. So welcome to the show. And as we wait, as we waste more time waiting for Flicted to get his act together.
Man, Flicted.
Jeez.
So we had a good geek.
Y'all said you wanted me to reboot my computer, so I'm rebooting my computer.
You waited until you got here. Thank you. So we had a good geek gathering this past weekend.
I was there.
Friday. Lee was there.
It was amazing.
He had a good time.
Groovehouse was there.
I did.
Groovehouse showed up. Was he there? No.
Yeah. Yeah, he was there. Yeah, he was there when I got there. I thought.
Sure, I was there.
No.
Jay just knowed you out of existence. Your Friday night doesn't exist anymore.
He wasn't there. He was still in Florida.
You weren't there? I thought he was there.
How many beers did you have?
Apparently.
Beer time.
Well, I guess I'm thinking of the post-DEFCON one, maybe. And I can't.
You're thinking
I can't
of the one before.
Were you at the last one?
I was at both of them.
Groovehouse was not at the Geek Gathering.
I know he wasn't on the last
I know show. This because he got in from Florida on Saturday, and he was making some comment about trying to find food and then get over. Or no, not about going to Motley Crue on Saturday. Was that Saturday? It was
Rock.
Saturday. He went to Motley Crue after just getting back from Florida. Whoa. And then I Facebooked him and had him come to the Big Top to watch Light Rock Express. So yeah. I was the first one to see him once he got back. I did not share him with any of the other geeks. It was just me, Groovehouse, rocking lightly with, you know, a handful of people watching.
Like rocking back and forth?
It was
light rocking.
It's more like swaying to the music.
Right. There you go.
So, yeah. So, no, he was not at the Geek Gathering.
I must be remembering the first post-DEFCON.
You were having, apparently, a Groovehouse moment. That's why you were sitting over there in the corner with the beer in your hand, looking off into space and kind of drooling.
No, I have no recollection of that either.
Yeah, so it was a good Geek Gathering. I mean, it was a little warm, but this cool breeze kept trying to come in.
Just flirting.
It wasn't too bad. It wasn't, you know, I keep thinking that we're really going to regret doing things at Coons, but we never do. It always ends up being kind of nice. We had a good turnout.
Yeah.
So I was really glad for that. People showed up. Some gentleman brought his child with him, his teenage son, who's getting into programming. So that was good to see.
Always refreshing.
Always.
Yeah. So the
next generation. Ask Jim Thompson what his goggles did, to which Jim's reply was nothing. They don't do anything. This is all they do. They blink around.
Yeah. So
although I don't believe that. I think
he's the blinking Jim now. So he was there with his he had these LED goggles where the lights twirled around and. Maybe that's why you thought you saw Groovehouse.
Mesmerized, just, yeah.
Colored lights can hypnotize.
Whoa.
Groovehouse is here.
Save us, Groovehouse!
Psychedelic, man.
Psychedelic. So, yeah, so thanks for everyone coming out. We are in the process of putting together our plans for our 20th anniversary gathering,
woo-hoo!
Party, whatever. We'll see how that goes. It looks like it's going to be at Cone's mid-October. We'll nail that down and get some more details out there. We hope to
save the date.
We hope that people will come out, especially, you know, the people that have not visited with us in a long time. We're hoping to see some old faces and just come on out and drink a toast to innocence. You have got to be kidding.
Isn't it?
I rebooted.
Wow.
Here's to isn't a since.
This is the greatest thing ever.
This is like the longest loop of.
That's incredible.
That's amazing. So, you know, you might remember a couple of weeks ago, how could you possibly forget that Pete's connection to the station was interrupted, throwing him into a perpetual loop
Max Headroom.
Of saying isn't. And,
isn't?
There isn't much happening isn't? When that happens. So you were here when that happened. No, you weren't.
I was not. I was away.
Are you sure?
You missed it.
Groovehouse and I think you were here.
I'm everywhere. Tried to be, but yeah, I couldn't get a connection up north.
Yeah, so he was in the wilderness. But anyway, so we've got continuing problems with the Skype Google thing to Pete. So I'm pretty happy to know that that's staying on course.
Are we not going to have a perfect show tonight?
I think we're already having a perfect show.
I think we're having a show that is pretty much in line with what you've come to expect from Technology Bites, and probably the kind of show that reminds you of why you're going to tune in next week during the fundraiser and pledge financial support. And also, we're having the kind of show that where our mistake is not being broadcast at the normally weak signal that we have, but at 100,000 watts.
Full power.
Full power. It sounds better even in the headphones here to know that we've, you know, raised the money and got that transmitter online. You know, it wasn't, this is a fancy transmitter, not like that one that got blowed up in the 70s. This one's bomb-proof. Oh, yeah?
Yeah, let's careful.
Careful now. Don't jinx it. So, all right, we're working on getting Peter Hughes on the air. We do have some news tonight. I know the Apple announcements. I want to leave that for Pete because he's the Apple guy. He's the, you know, he's the one that infected us all, so.
Pew, pew, pew. Pew, pew.
How was your... I forgot how easily abused he is.
Pew, pew. Doesn't take much, sir.
That's good, because I don't have much. What were you going to say?
I was just going to wonder what's...
Is Laura tweeting at you?
No. Someone going to pick that up?
He's trying. That...
It's Peter calling.
Peter's trying to call?
Yeah.
He's only the highest of high technology on this show. ISDN lines
Mom,
and...
I'm on the phone.
Direct connections and Google Hangouts and things.
Awesome. La 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 la. So you got to be part of the news today, right? In your role as far as Technica.
Should I stop typing and actually do the show here?
I'll type for you.
type away. Type like the wind, Barrett. Yes, Apple had a huge big thing today, and like Jay said, we're going to leave it for Peter to really get into the specifics, but. We Ars Technica. That's my day job. We were on site at the the Bill Graham Pavilion, whatever venue that Apple was using. We had a guy there, Andrew Cunningham, who's our Apple editor person, and was live blogging. And these things are always kind of hit or miss. When you do a live blog, it's kind of an industry term. If you follow a lot of tech websites, you'll see live blogs come up from time to time for tech events like this. And generally what that means is somebody is sitting here. The isn't-ing going on in the background. Yeah. Somebody is generally sitting in the audience of the event. And sometimes the vendor is kind enough to allow them to bring a second person as a photographer, and sometimes they're Iron Man live blogging it, taking pictures and typing as they go. And the reason why, I mean, even now, it's generally pretty easy to find a live stream, like an actual video live stream of these kind of events, and yet we get all these, I mean, and it's not just us, it's a lot of tech websites get all this feedback from folks who are generally, when these events happen, they're like, they're at work, they can't have a video window open, like streaming live video, or whatever place they work for doesn't allow streaming video to come in, so some places are still doing that. And so, like, actually having someone in the audience typing text, like basically a text transcription of what's going on, live blogging it, are still super popular. So... We were doing that this morning, and we had a little bit of a connection issue, which often happens when you've got thousands of tech journalists, or at least many, many, many
Or
hundreds,
just a handful at a radio station.
Yeah, crammed into a tiny area all on Wi-Fi, the connectivity was a little spotty, so we ended up having a really neat system of relayed text and IRC that I was having to type into our into our content management system to run the live blog as our guy on the ground was frantically typing stuff. Anyway, it was really exciting. Keeps the adrenaline going, and it's like the airplane wing fell off in flight and somebody had to get out there and bolt it back on. It was fun stuff. And we did get everything, got everything reported, the event concluded.
What kind of traffic do you get for an event like that?
Very much a lot.
Very much a lot.
Generally, I don't know how many numbers I'm supposed to talk about. Millions of page views.
Billions
out of like
and
that.
Billions.
Many millions of
is,
page views.
Has Ars Technica become a place to go for that kind of thing now?
I think Ars Technica has always been a place to go for that kind of thing. I mean, I'm just coming up on, what's today, the 9th?
Yes.
It is.
So tomorrow is my 10th. Tomorrow is my third service anniversary for working at Ars, but I've been a reader forever and ever and ever. And since probably the early 2000s, since about the time that OS X started to get really noticeable, Ars has been kind of a big force in the tech news world in general and on the Apple news beat in specific, generally because they've had a couple of very, very good, very dedicated Apple-focused people working there. And it's something that we've kept on now that I'm there, for what it's worth, even though I'm not as Apple-focused as some of the other people have been in the past. But yeah, it's Ars, I think, you know, distancing myself and thinking as a reader is a site that you'd go to for quality Apple news, I think. Well, sir. It's one of the destination sites. I mean, there's Ars Technica, there's The Verge, there's 9 to 5 Mac, Apple Rumors from time to time.
/Dot.
I'm
joking around.
Slashdot really isn't relevant
anymore. Come
on,
don't you dare say it's not relevant anymore.
It's
that means a lot of us aren't relevant anymore.
As a cultural touchstone, Slashdot will always be relevant.
Yes.
How's that?
How diplomatic and journalistic of you.
Indeed.
Hey, Pete.
I can hear Pete saying something other than it's.
Yeah, really.
That's
the weirdest thing. It's been weeks. I don't get it.
Somebody should call Google. Tell them what's up.
I'd like to report a glitch in the Matrix.
And then they'll say, is it? wow, is it already 20 after?
Yeah, it is, sir.
Nice. Nice.
More thing.
Yeah. Say isn't for a few more times.
Well, hopefully we can set up a permanent machine on there and maybe do some direct point-to-point without any kind of middle server stuff might help.
That'd be nice. All right, so welcome to the show. If you want to visit us online, you can visit us at geekradio.com. We're also hanging out on IRC, irc.cuckoo.com. I said cuckoo.com, and it's the channel Tech Bytes on irc.cuckoo.com, and if you don't have your own IRC client, you're welcome to use ours, which we publish on our website, so feel free to link up to that. And since we now have Peter Hughes on the air and ready to go, let's go ahead and do the Technology Bytes Info Shot live from San Antonio. If it works, fingers crossed, take it away, Info Shot.
It's the Technology Bytes Info Shot. Technology news and commentary by Peter Hughes. Injected directly into your skull.
All right. Well, let's see. As I'm starting this, I'm finding one of my links is bad on the news, so I will have to fix that. If you're a Russian state-sponsored hacker, or if you're not a Russian, if you're any kind of state-sponsored hacker siphoning data from targeted computers, The key thing is your command and control server, and you don't want people to be able to find that and shut it down and halt your ability to communicate with your infected machines. Wired and Ars Technica both had articles about the Russian-speaking spy gang known as Turla, and their solution for their command and control servers is to hijack the satellite IP addresses of legitimate users and use those to steal data from other infected machines in a way that hides their command server. Researchers at Kaspersky have found evidence that the Turla gang has been using the covert technique since at least 2007. They're believed to be sponsored by the Russian government, which is more than a decade targeted government agencies, embassies, and militaries in more than 40 countries, of course, including Kazakhstan, China, Vietnam, and the U.S., but with a particular emphasis on countries in the former Eastern Bloc. Turlygang uses a number of techniques to infect systems and steal data, but for some of its most high-profile targets, the group appears to use a satellite-based communication technique designed to help hide the location of their command servers. This is according to Kaspersky. Ordinarily, hackers will lease a server or hack somebody else's to use the command station, and the way they hide it is they route their activity through multiple proxies, things like that. But, you know, eventually, if somebody is dogged enough, they can find the actual command and control server, just keep following the jumps until they get back to the original one. According to Stefan Tenace, senior security researcher with Kaspersky, the CNC servers are the central point of failure for cybercrime or espionage. Hence the technique used by the Turla hackers, which Tenace called exquisite, because it allows the attackers to hide their command server from researchers and law enforcement agencies that would seize them. Satellite internet providers cover a wider geographical area than regular internet service providers. You know, satellite coverage can extend for more than 1,000 miles and span multiple countries and even continents. So tracking the location of a computer using a satellite IP address can be more difficult. So the key thing is, the most widespread and least expensive types of satellite connectivity is downstream only. Which people sometimes use for faster downloads. Satellite connections tend to provide larger bandwidth than some other connections. Traffic coming out of the user's computer will go through a dial-up or other connection, while traffic coming in goes through the satellite connection. You know, that's like the HughesNet kind of thing, at least has generally been in the past, the cheap ones. Because the satellite communication isn't encrypted, hackers can point an antenna at the traffic to intercept the data, or in the case of the Turla hackers, determine the IP address of a legitimate satellite user in order to hack it. So they found these vulnerabilities were made public in 2009 and 2010 at Black Hat, but Turla appears to have been using the vulnerabilities since at least 2007. Kaspersky found a sample of their malware that appears to have been compiled that year. It contained two hard-coded IP addresses for communicating with a command server, one of them an address that belonged to a German satellite internet provider. To use a hijacked satellite connection for exfiltrating data, the attacker first infects a targeted computer with malware that contains a hard-coded domain name for his command server. But instead of the domain name using a static IP address, the hackers use dynamic DNS hosting, which allows them to change the IP address for the domain at will. Then the attacker uses an antenna to pick up satellite traffic in his region and collects a list of IP addresses belonging to legitimate users. He can then configure the domain name for his command server to use one of the satellite IP addresses. The malware will then contact the legitimate satellite internet user's IP address to initiate the connection, but that user's machine will drop the connection since it wasn't expecting it. The same route request will also go to the attacker's command and control computer, which is using the same IP address, which will reply correctly to the infected machine and establish a communication channel to receive the data siphoned from the infected machine. I mean, it's pretty brilliant. Any data that gets siphoned from the infected machine will also go to the innocent user's system, but basically ignores it and drops it. The only thing would be that the only way you would notice if you happen to have be a satellite user is if you checked your log files and noticed that there were packets being dropped by the satellite modem, requests that the person didn't ask for. The method isn't reliable for long-term exfiltration of data, since these satellite internet connections are one way and can be very unreliable. The attacker will also lose the satellite connection once the innocent user whose IP address he has hijacked goes offline. So that's why, according to Tenace, that's why they only use it for the most high-profile targets. But so just it's interesting to see kind of when these stories come out that go into more depth about how this works, because obviously with IP addresses and that, you have to be more there's a real location data has to go to, and you can track that down. And so it's kind of, you know, it's kind of like if you had to try to do your crime by phone, a landline, it's traceable. But now with this, it's not. Apparently, this isn't very expensive to accomplish either. All it requires is a satellite dish, some cable, and a satellite modem, which would set you back about $1,000. It's not the first time the Kaspersky researchers have seen groups using satellite connections for command servers. Today's Set's hacking team, the Italy-based firm that sells surveillance tools to law enforcement and intelligence agencies, also has used satellite IP addresses for the command and control servers that communicate with its software. But in these cases, the internet connections appear to have been purchased by hacking team's law enforcement subscribers. The Charlie Group has used so many different satellite IP addresses that Tanae says it's clear they're hijacking them from legitimate users. Tanae says the technique, if adopted by criminal gangs in the future, will make it harder for law enforcement agencies and researchers to track command servers and shut them down. Isn't that nice? So that part is not so good, but the sad part is exploits that have been known since 2009. You know, okay, so they get free use from 2007 to 2009 if they really started using it in 2007. But once the vulnerabilities have been made clear, leaving that going basically is just an invitation for criminals. So that's not a great treat for it doesn't speak well of doesn't speak well for the companies that you know, are providing these services. Well, and my other article is just not gonna work. I messed up the URL and so I'm not going to be able to find that one. I think the key thing tonight, I think we're talking about it a little bit before we came into the news, is really a combo of it combines all of our first three segments, which is news, bite of the apple because of all the Apple announcements, and then that kind of bleeds into try, buy, or fry. So maybe the thing is to if somebody wants to play the new Bite of the Apple bumper, we'll just go into the new stuffs from Apple.
We could do that.
Yes, we could do that. Here, I got it.
You got it?
I've got it. Oh, there's only one bumper. It doesn't say scary or happy anymore.
Play
it
the
says
one.
Scary happy. All right, Scappy. Here we go. Getting there.
Bite.
I see.
Basically, I just mixed it together in the way that we've kind of been using it anyway. So the big news is, frankly, I think, you know, nobody else seems to be able to do this. I mean, lots of other companies have tried to have these kinds of days.
I paid no attention, so I have absolutely zero idea of what about to
I've
be
released
discussed.
A new version of Steve Jobs.
Zombie Steve Jobs came up on the there's a lot of the rumors obviously were the rumors were all pretty much on target. There is a new iPad Pro that's a 12.9 inch tablet that's designed for work, that's designed for the workplace. It's got a apparently it looks like a grown-up iPad Air, a full-size software keyboard, which it can easily house, you know, because essentially, you know, the 13-inch screen, it's the size of, you know, your, I don't know, your any kind of 13-inch computer monitor.
So they renamed the MacBook Air iPad?
No. Yeah, really. Essentially, they just took all the MacBook Air stuff and stuffed it in. Although it's got the, it's still using its iOS. And it obviously has the iPad processor.
That's a new version of it. It has the A9X is their new SoC they've announced for it.
And it's got a Retina display, so it has more pixels. It has 5.6 million pixels, which is more than the 15-inch MacBook Pro with Retina display has. It has four speakers in it. and more room, obviously, with that size to pack in battery. So it has a projected 10 hours of battery life under use. The A96 chip, as Lee mentioned, the doubles memory bandwidth and doubled storage performance. It's 1.8 times faster than the CPU it's replacing, according to Phil Schiller, Apple Senior VP. The graphics performance is 360 times better than the original iPad, and this year saw the biggest jump in its ability. It's faster than 90% of the portable PCs that shipped in the last 12 months. So it's not like it's not detuned lightweight hardware. So there's the whole multitasking, you know, the split screen run two apps, overlay a video on top of whatever else you're working on stuff is why it's got the serious hardware. It's got the biggest suite of iPad-focused software upgrades since the device first came out. It has a stylus that's called the Apple Pencil that you pay extra for, but that, according to people who have used it, is the most, you know, lag-free, accurate-feeling stylus that's out.
Did you have to pay for a stylus with a Newton?
No.
Apple's changed so much.
they've sold out. Well, that was back. That was the Scully days. That was before Steve Jobs came back. And it's got a. They also announced the Smart Keyboard, which is an accessory keyboard for the Pro. It has three circle connectors on the side called Smart Connectors, which carry power and data, and it connects magnetically to the. The keyboard connects to the iPad Pro, but yeah, people who've used styli, you know, I've seen some of the people who got some hands-on time, and they said it was pretty incredible. It's so precise; it's supposed to be able to quote touch a single pixel. The pricing, as you may have wondered about, the iPad Pro. For a 32 gig with Wi-Fi starts about $800, 128 gigs with Wi-Fi about $950, and 128 gigs with Wi-Fi and cellular is about $1,050, and that'll be out in November.
How does that compare to the regular current iPad line pricing before this announcement?
Let me see.
Well, the third.
I'm just curious. I mean, it doesn't seem like an insane price or anything, good or bad, but I'm curious how it compares
to
what.
It's not. I mean, you know.
Like maybe $650, $550.
Let's go to the Apple Store website and find out.
It'll probably be down.
No. It's up. It's been up.
Usually it's crashed.
It was down. They're learning. They're actually getting better about keeping everything up after after everything goes one of these shows. So okay,
back.
The iPad Air 2 would be the previous latest model. Scrolling. Exactly.
Keep that finger rolling. Well, I think it started at like $499 for a 16 gig Wi-Fi. And then they didn't offer a 32. I think it went 16, then like just like the phones, I think it went 16, 64.
Vanish into the ether.
128.
Yes.
Thanks, Pete.
Yeah, starts at the old one, the iPad Air 2.
Without super mentioning prices.
Without really getting into it. Yeah, $500 bucks at the low end, and then all crazy maxed out with cellular. Ooh, I want a gold one. Let's see. Click all of these things. A little under $900.
For the big one?
For the iPad Air 2. So are the they new trying... one...
For the old
latest one.
900?
It's 128 gigs of storage.
Did they drop the prices on those today?
They may have dropped the prices on them too. I don't know. I wasn't really paying attention to that part.
Are they trying to take on like Microsoft Surface as far as trying to get into
the business?
There
have been a lot of comparisons with Surface. Although if you listen to Apple's pitch, they're already huge in businesses, they say. They bring up healthcare. They bring up their healthcare plays really strong, and they keep bringing that up over and over and over again, because I think they've had a lot of successes with early adopters in the healthcare space. And they keep bringing up two or three different verticals where they say they've been very, very successful.
Doctors really like iPads.
They do. They really do. But as a function of...
Okay, this is iPad only, not OS X in general. So yeah, they're not really in the business elsewhere. Not really.
I mean, just looking at iOS penetration in business verticals in general, it's strong in some, not strong in others. I think if you look at it as a function of, purely as a function of units sold, Surface probably walks all over them in business. I mean, and not necessarily just Surface, but also like the Dell, what's Dell's Surface-like tablet, the XP whatever. Dell has a Surface-like that I know has gotten a lot of play. CCISD down here in the Clear Lake League City area uses the Dell Surface knockoffs for tons and tons of stuff. I think they're the standard issue portable they use. And yeah, but so I mean,
Apple's the iPad Pro, with their alliance with IBM, Apple is seriously moving to push into the business world.
Oh, that was the other one. Yes, you're right, Pete. Absolutely. Yeah, Apple keeps bringing that up over and over again. They've got like a big B2B alliance with IBM, and they're pushing all of these big business-to-business and business collaborative apps and stuff. It's just not an area that I pay much attention to, but I'm sure somebody's watching it really
closely. I think
it's
closely. What Steve Jobs always wanted. Do you guys see Wozniak did a couple of interviews that weren't, I don't know if they were like supposed to be interviews, but he was speaking at an elementary school and was fielding questions from the kids, and some serious questions came up. He was very candid, and then now they're all over YouTube. So for instance, someone asked him, they were speaking to Wozniak. They asked Steve Wozniak, how much did Steve Jobs actually contribute to anything? And pretty much, he said, this is a quote, he said, okay, said Steve Jobs played no role at all in my designs of the Apple I and Apple II computer, the printer and interfaces and serial interfaces and floppy disks and stuff that I made to enhance the computers. He didn't know technology. He wanted to be important, and the important people are always the business people. So that's what he wanted to do. Wow.
Yeah, but I buy that, though. I mean, I don't think Jobs ever made, even before his death, even when like people were still actively asking him about the history of the company that he built, I don't think he ever really...
Never
he really made too many bones
it,
about
but
knowing the tech
he
side.
Never said that I have absolutely no idea how any of this works and I'm not a technologist. He always framed himself as the technologist, and really he was more a user of technology, maybe, and everyone says visionary, maybe, and having vision.
But he made
but
and sold
no doubt
blue
that
boxes.
Woz did stuff.
Woz right. made and sold blue boxes. Yeah. I don't doubt
with the help of Captain Crunch.
I don't doubt that Steve Jobs has had a good understanding, especially when he grew up, came back from Next and like became like the second version of Steve Jobs. I don't doubt that he had like a really good understanding of the technology side, but I don't think that understanding extended down into the code level. Absolutely not.
The other thing you brought though is the kind of, that's just sort of the weird combination of things that he was into. Technologists like Woz, frankly, didn't really care about what type looked like on the screen. It was enough if it looked, you could read it and things like that. And so some of the magic in what Apple ended up doing ultimately came from Jobs being ahead of wanting things that weren't available yet.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely right.
Well, a lot of the engineers, when Woz included, they didn't really care how they looked or how they dressed or anything about, anything other than just getting the zeros and the ones to flow through the wire there. So that's fair.
Jobs' reputation was he was the cool guy who, could date girls and all that other stuff, where the rest of them, including Bill Gates, weren't.
Well, and you can see a lot of that in, I think I brought it up before, there's a great website, folklore.org, that's a collection of anecdotes from during the design of the Macintosh. It's written by, there's several contributors, but it's mainly written by Andy Hertzfeld, who was one of the ROM designers on the original, he worked on the Apple II also, but he was a ROM designer for the Mac. and there's tons of stories about Steve Jobs and how Steve Jobs acted in those early days. There's a famous one on there where Jobs went into the Apple II, or I'm sorry, into the Macintosh work area, at it may have been in the Bandley buildings at that point. Anyway, went into the Macintosh work area, saw that hardware designer Burl Smith, who was a hardware genius and responsible for much of the hardware side of the Mac, was working on a prototype Apple board to go inside as they were finalizing all the tooling. And Steve Jobs was like, you have to rearrange the entire circuit layout of the logic board because it's ugly, it's not symmetrical, it has to be rearranged, the RAM has to go here, it has to look like this and be lined up. And, you know, Burl and Andy and the rest of the engineers were like, well, you know, Steve, we can't do that. These, you know, these components are arranged this way because the electrical traces have to be a certain length and blah. And Steve was like, I don't care, change it. I don't care how much it costs, change it. And then they were like, well, if we change it, it might not work. And Steve was like, well, change it first. And if it doesn't work, then we can do it your way. But I want to make sure that it doesn't work my way first.
And we're live demoing this in 12 hours. Yeah. Get to it.
Sure enough, they re-prototyped the board, and it didn't work nearly as well in Steve Jobs' aesthetic layout. And they went with Burl Smith's original layout. But that's, you know, Steve Jobs.
Paying attention to those details. The thing is, though, then the world caught up with him, because if you think about, you know, I remember when the cheese grater Mac Pro desktop came out, and they showed the pictures where when you opened that thing up and looked at it, it was pretty much a thing of beauty inside. You know, when you opened the side of the computer and you looked at all the components, it was all organized and it was all clean and it was a it was powerful, but
oh, yeah.
You know, a lot of it was him being a little bit ahead of his time. If you think about it, sort of the stuff he did with the Mac where he wanted it to be very efficient, so it should only have 128K and that kind of stuff, really had value, but it was 20 years later when they did the iPad, when having enough, you know, when you didn't have to go wild on the amount of memory and all that kind of stuff to have your system work. In a sense, you can really draw a direct line from the you know, the old first Macs and like the Mac Plus to the iPad as far as the kind of aesthetic and those kinds of things. And a lot of that, the ingredient to that, a lot of it, you know, I'm not, Steve Jobs also was not a pleasant person, and we all benefited, I think, from not working with someone like that.
No, that's you know, there's stories about that too. But I mean, you can't get away from the fact that he focused on industrial design in an era when not many other computer companies were all that concerned about industrial design. He drew a lot of his influence from some of the famous German industrial designers, and the overall aesthetic was way better because of it.
Was he there during the design of the iMac G3? Because Grape was so-so, but the Tangerine was visionary.
Yeah, he was there for that.
Really? I feel bad for that. That was, I mean, that ugly, weird plasticine era before they went metal.
Yeah,
metal's
No. He did that. That was the whole thing. The lickable iMacs. He came back in 1997,
That was the first big thing he put out. I think.
Yeah, that was the first major. Like he did like three big things when he came back. Was he killed the Newton? He severed the agreements with the Apple clone makers, and then he scrapped and redid the product line because, I mean, I think anybody who's been doing computers for a long time remembers that there was that time period in the, probably from about 1992 right up about 1997.
You could get a computer in any color you want.
Well, it wasn't just that. Beige. No, what I was going with it is there was that time period where, like, Macintosh, Apple made so many Macintosh models. How many Centrises were there? How many Performas were there? How many different Quadras were there? I mean, Pete, you were in that world. How many, off the top of your head, how many different Performa models can you name?
Oh, God. Well, there was like, usually they started with, what, three? There was like the 600, the 700, and the 900, or the 800, and then they had all kinds of, and you had to look, you had to know between the different types between Performa and the other as far as which ones really did what you wanted.
Yeah, it was a wreck.
And Apple was kind of sluggish, and their performance was not up to what you could get from a white, you know, build it yourself Intel box.
There's an apocryphal story, and it may be true, but as far as I know, it's only apocryphal, that Steve Jobs walked into one of the conference rooms in Cupertino where as he was being brought back in as the interim CEO, and on the conference table, as he had instructed the people to do, they'd laid out like one of everything. And it was like the whole conference table was like overflowing with different Macs and different printers and, you know, digital cameras and the Apple microwave and whatever else Apple was like trying to push in the mid to late 90s. And he basically said, we have to throw all this away. And he went up to the whiteboard and drew just a grid, a 2x2 grid, and said that our product strategy going forward is going to have home and pro, and then to have a low end and a high end in each one. So like a home user and a pro user, and have a basic and an advanced for each one, and like that's it. And that's sort of kind of the way that they've stuck since that, although now they've got the mobile line on top of that too. But I mean, generally you've got, like with the Mac, or maybe it was home and, or maybe it was portable and desktop. Anyway, it was a 2x2
grid.
What
is it now with the MacBook Air and the MacBook Pro? I think they're starting to blend again.
The MacBook Air and the MacBook Pro and the MacBook. But then on the desktop, there's the iMac and the Mac Pro. It's one and the other, and it's the base or the fast one.
Yeah.
I mean, they stuck relatively close to the formula of keeping sort of simplified product lines. I mean, it's sort of creeped a little bit. But still, it's nowhere near like it was, where you're like, I need to go buy a Quadra. Well, I don't see, which Quadra do I need? Well, there's 47 different Quadra models. I don't know which one I want.
Yeah, one looks like a pizza box, and one looks like a rectangle, and the other one's a sort of a cylinder.
And they're all identified by vague numbers after the name that don't actually mean anything.
The yeah, and don't tell you from year to year what the heck anything did. But one of the interesting things with the iPad Pro is it gets up into the upper range where when you put a keyboard and a stylus with it, which that basically roughly adds about $300 to your purchase.
Yeah, I think it was.
And you put that with the 128 gig, suddenly you're at around $1,300, which means that you're choosing between a low-end MacBook, the Retina MacBook, or a high-end MacBook Air, or, you know, that it starts, they're all in the same general vicinity price-wise, and it will be interesting to see who feels like that the iPad Pro meets their needs versus, at, you know, with the stylus and that kind of stuff.
I don't know, Pete, I've got to say, I'm generally a big desktop fan and desktop operating system fan. I mean, I'm not one of those guys that's carrying around an iPad, even though I do a lot of my work mobile. I use a MacBook Air because I like the desktop operating system. I like the input device choices and all that stuff. But I'm looking at all the coverage of the iPad Pro, and I'm feeling for the first time ever a little tempted by the going mobile like that.
You see it in your fingers, kind of like want to grab, want to get it.
They kind of do, and it's the first time. Even like as the iPads have gone through their revisions, they haven't really been all that attractive to me because I need to be able to run, you know, 15 billion different applications all at the same time and do all kinds of stuff, and especially do photo processing and everything. And now all of a sudden, all of that just is looking a lot easier.
Now, are they going to bring in, you said that this was iOS, right?
Yes.
Pure iOS. So it's not quite like the Surface where you're running legitimate Windows and you can run, you know, like off-the-shelf software, you know, downloadable software. This, you would still have to do everything you want. You'd still have to get those apps.
That is correct.
They're never going to do any kind of a crossover. Has there ever been any kind of a talk of, you know, some kind of a crossover?
Who knows what
thing
Apple
that lets
will
you build and you know, lets you run software?
There have been things that they've stepped, there have been over the years, there are the steps have been in place where Apple has moved OS X and iOS towards each other. For instance, things like the way you scroll on a Apple laptop, it's natural scrolling where you push towards the screen, push up, because that's what you would do on a tablet, and some of those kinds of interface things. I think they know the day will come when it moves to one operating system and the different hardware platforms are that diverse, I think.
Maybe.
But they unless it turns out that this works, because I mean I don't think anybody that's got an iPad says, oh, you know, there's not that many programs that you go, oh, I wish it had this, because I mean Microsoft is already announced and is big, their Office suite is available for the iPad. And particularly, apparently, they've done some special stuff for the iPad Pro.
Yeah, I mean, they were up there on stage, actually. A lot of people were commenting that the Microsoft presence at the Big Apple announcement keynote was like shades of Bill Gates' 1997 Apple bailout announcement a little bit. But yeah, I mean, they were talking about special features that the iOS version of Microsoft Office will have that'll support the new iPad Pro. I mean, the integration is there on the productivity side. It's just a question of like, how much work can you really get done on this platform? The two big partners that were there presenting were Microsoft and Adobe. Adobe was out there with their own demo stuff. And I mean, between those two, between Office and like the Adobe Creative Suite side of things, that covers a pretty large set of use cases for content creation of any kind.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Well, and that stylus for, you know, photo editing and that kind of stuff, basically being able to edit right on the screen. Oh, and yeah, if it really does have kind of pixel perfect precision.
Is it Retina or is it?
It's Retina. It's got a better Retina display supposedly than the MacBook Pro with Retina display. Yeah. It has more pixels. The 13-inch iPad has more pixels than the 15-inch MacBook Pro.
This could be one of the first times where you could actually use your Apple TV to throw what you're seeing on your device to a screen smaller than your device.
I think I do think there's a real possibility. A lot of people's workplace, their functions, an iPad with a sufficient size screen actually would cover what people really need. Most people in an office don't need it if they're not a coder or doing something that needs heavy duty hardware. They certainly don't need a desktop machine, and a lot of them, even a laptop, is kind of more than they really, really need to mess with. And so with the kind of battery life that with a 10-hour battery life on it and all that, somebody going meeting to meeting would be able to use this. It's a good content consumer. I think that there may be that, you know, and with it, it may be quicker and easier to have sort of custom solutions that focus on it, where Surface is Windows, and so you still have to, it has to work across all, you know, it still needs to work on the laptop, and it still needs, you know, you can't play to the strengths of the platform without pointing out weaknesses in, you know, or differences with the same operating system on different hardware.
Are the new, I didn't pay much attention to the announcement today, I know, shame on me, but do we know if the new iPads are sporting the hardware enhancements of the iPhone 6S, like the new higher resolution camera?
I don't remember if they got into talking about the camera on the iPad Pro or not.
Those things are going to be really annoying at concerts.
I already know about the large format phones. I like that there's a backlash among musicians to mock and ridicule people holding up those to take pictures. Because usually I'm standing directly in back of the person, you know, holding up the whole iPad thing to take pictures. And I see that on vacation a lot, too.
I don't people mind. People start taking pictures with full time. I'm not against the iPad as a camera. I've actually used an iPad as a camera, like, you know, hold it up and take a picture. So I like that big viewfinder. As I get older, I could frame up the shot, but if the camera was better, I could see using it more. But no, it is kind of ridiculous looking as it is with just a normal iPad. I could only imagine someone holding up an iPad Pro.
Holding up a picture frame like this big.
Oh, that way you can multitask. You can record the concert while watching a different concert on the screen.
Well, I know that they talked about on the iPhone 6S that they have the 4-megapixel camera on the front-facing camera. It does HD video.
Right.
4K, maybe.
Does 4K now. Well, the rear-facing one does 4K.
Yeah, right. But there's some enhancements there, so that's kind of appealing. I'm not going to be buying the new iPhone 6S out of the chute. I can't wait for the 7 now. Of course, you know, we've got all the announcements out today. Can't wait for the next thing.
Well, though that's the thing that sort of it makes sense. You know, your phone should at least, I think at minimum, should work for 2 years. You know, the people who have to have the next model every time one comes out, I think that's more a product of want than need. You know, it doesn't, you know, sure, if you were somebody who really needs, I don't know, be able to shoot 4K video with your phone, you know, then good luck with the 16 gig, you know, base model. you know, 20 seconds of video and you've just filled up your hard drive kind of thing, but or your memory for the whole thing. But I think a lot of it, the iPads get the features first. I'm looking at the different articles I found, and nobody's really talking about, because I don't think Apple really talked about the cameras. They do for the phones, because that's, I guess, a more competitive thing. The big thing they changed is the camera that faces you is now a 12 megapixel, where it's been 8. It had stayed at 8 for quite a while now.
That doesn't sound right. The one that faces you is like 4. It was like 1.5 to 2
previously. Oh wait, no, it's 5. The front facing FaceTime camera. Okay, so there's the EyeSight sensor and the FaceTime camera. Right. The EyeSight is the one on the back that you take pictures of other things with.
Correct.
And so that one goes to 12 megapixels, and the one on the front goes to 5. And the upgraded phones can use the screen as a flash to help light images. So that should up your selfie game with your new phone.
I wonder what the selfie stick's going to look like for the iPad Pro.
It's enormous!
That's an accident waiting to happen.
I think some of these things are features you need to use before you're really going to know whether, first off, they're useful and what they're good for. The kind of force touch thing, and the 3D touch, as they were talking about. Apparently, like taking photos, there's a new thing called Live Photos, where if you use the 3D touch on an image, or it takes the feature when you've got it, it's automatic. It takes some additional picture and sound data before and after the moment of a photograph. And when you force touch the picture, it will begin to move and play the sound. So it's in a sense, it's kind of like a version of the sort of Harry Potter thing. But I wonder if it's not more about figuring out something that was a need for the like 3D touch feature. And there's a lot more, I guess, for the second hour of the show.
All right. Well, thanks for everybody for tuning in and making it to the show tonight for the first half of Technology Bites. We have some station business we have to tend to, so we're going to tend to some station business, but we'll be right back after these messages. You are listening to Technology Bites. I'm Jay Lee.
I'm Peter Hughes.
I'm Flicted.
I'm Barrett.
I'm Lee.
And he's
Groovehouse.
The Summer Sizzle Fun Drive is over, but the needs of your Pacifica radio station still go on. KPFT and Electro Love Radio Show are having a fundraiser November 7th at Last Concert Cafe. Electro Love Fest will have bands from Houston and Austin, and we're looking for supporters interested in the great perks sponsors will receive. For information on how individuals, artists, professionals, social groups and businesses can enjoy the benefits of sponsoring, call Robin Lewis at 713-526-4000, extension 315. She'll be happy to help you, and we want to thank Houston for keeping us on the air for 45 years. We hope to see you there.
cooking. They'll get something cooking.
Did you know you can find KPFT on the social networking sites Twitter and Facebook? You certainly can, and we'd love you to add us as a friend and get us connected with friends of yours. Join our fan page and check out a special video message from General Manager Dwayne Bradley, as well as keep up with KPFT programmers and staff. Visit facebook.com/KPFT Houston to join us. To follow us, visit twitter.com/KPFT. With both, you can link up with other KPFT listeners, get the latest news about the station, and find lots of extras. It's fun, so catch up with KPFT online. Again, on Twitter, visit twitter.com/KPFT. On Facebook, visit us at facebook.com/KPFT Houston. This is commercial-free, listener-sponsored Pacifica Radio, 90.1 KPFT Houston.
You're listening to 90.1 FM KPFT Houston. And now, for a very, very special surprise. You're not going to believe this, everybody. Listen to this. Hey, Barrett. What's happening?
I don't know.
Well, room around town.
We interrupt this skit to bring you...
Barrett time! Barrett time! Barrett time!
Yeah. That means it's time for
Bear time.
Yeah. Anyway, take it away, Barrett.
I'm just kidding. I don't have Barrett time. No. All right. No. We've
sick burn.
We've missed a lot of Barrett time, so we're gonna have to make up some ground with this one. I'd say we've missed. I suppose I should say I've missed, but I think that this sits squarely on the shoulders of Jay Lee. He's kind of letting things go around here. I mean, Groove House doesn't feel like he's gonna answer the phones anymore. And what's with this chatty new guy? I'm sorry. That's just me lashing out. It bugs me that Dwight isn't here to help me with the hard math of actually calculating the exact number of Barrett times I've missed. So how many have I actually missed? Let's see. Ta-da. Carry the one. Still not a believer in the new math, and I think I got it. So Dwight's not here to check my work, but I think I backed into the correct date. So here we go. 75 years ago today, George Stevens was the first person to successfully connect to a computing device remotely via telephone. So a 14-pair teletype cable was used to connect to his complex number generator at Bell Labs from Dartmouth College, making it possible for future generations of 14-year-olds to terrorize Ma Bell and later the internet with their phone-freaking ways. If you go to McNutt Hall, you'll find a bronze panel that reads, "In this building on September 9th, 1940, George Robert Sibbets, then a mathematician with Bell Telephone Laboratories, first demonstrated the remote operation of an electrical digital computer. Sibbets, who conceived the electrical digital computer in 1937 at Bell Labs, described his invention of the complex number calculator at a meeting in the Mathematical Association of America held here. Members of the audience transmitted problems to the computer at Bell Labs in New York City, and in seconds received solutions transmitted from the computer to a teletypewriter in this hall." So pretty cool, 75 years. And while I still affirm that Turing was the true father of the modern computer, I will give Stibitz credit with coining the term digital, or at least getting it in the books. During World War II, he noticed that the fire control devices for large artillery fell into two camps, analog and pulse. And in a memo written after attending an Office of Scientific Research and Development meeting, he proposed that digital be used in place of pulse, as pulse didn't accurately describe the true nature of these types of fire controls. So while doctors have been using digital to describe things associated with one's fingers, not the Unix command, Stibitz was the first one to apply it in the realm of computing. So, hopping back from the war effort, back to 9-9, we go to Harvard, September 9th, 1947, where computer operators are troubleshooting the Harvard University Mark II Aiken Relay Calculator. So, working panel by panel, they find a problem behind the 6th. A moth had become affixed, or kind of cooked, onto the 70th relay in panel F. And instead of parting like it was 9999, they glued or taped the bug to the logbook and wrote, "First actual case of a bug being found." So, while not the first application of the word bug to a computer glitch, this definitely helped popularize the term debugging. And does anyone know who was at the helm of the team of troubleshooters? Y'all know this. We just rephrased. It was Admiral Grace Murray Hopper.
Oh, I knew that.
Yep, y'all knew this. Yep,
yeah,
yep, yep.
I knew that.
So, now going on to more. So, 9999. Does anyone know the significance of this date?
$9.99?
Yeah, like $9.99. I also like, while you guys think about that, I like to point that I'm only 16 years back now, so that's two-thirds of the way through. So it's not, this isn't a hint, by the way. One other hint is Rogue Value. $9.99, Rogue Value. We've gone a little bit further. So the let me try this, okay.
It
so
means...
Or, as they say in Europe, the 9999 bug. Get it? Because the nines are transposed. It was the little brother to the Y2K bug. So while Y2K revolved around the problem that only the last two digits of the year were stored as data, thus the possibility existed that some systems may think it was 1900 instead of 2000, shutting down power grids, nuclear missile controls, and generally bring about the end of the digital world, which still doesn't explain the horrible CGI and the slew of Y2K disaster movies. The 9999 bug was supposed to detonate on September 9th, 1999. So I'm not too sure why the Y2K bug got more attention, other than it was easier to blame the problem on programmers long since retired, rather than own up to the fact that the bad practices that brought about the 9999 bug are still in use today. So is anyone familiar with it or want to take a guess? 9999, how it worked? Nope. Notice how the other programmer here is quiet. Pete, you're in a safe environment. You're among friends. You can confide in us. Can you show us on the UML diagram where the bad code touched you? So what it was, so what it was, instead of using like a null value, programmers have often just banged on the 9 key when they needed to represent an unknown value in a date field. So, you know, instead of saying like, hey, this is null, or hey, it's whatever, if they didn't know a date, be it a birth date or whatever date, they kind of used a magic value that was 9999. What's worse, this magic date flag often triggers code to execute that wouldn't or shouldn't normally run. You know, things like test functions that threw away data rather than storing it, or even executing reinstalls of certain system components. So in many ways, much more dangerous than getting a year wrong on a credit card bill. So the one bright spot in the run-up to the impending Y2K disaster was the 1999 Sega Dreamcast released on the same date. So again, another $9.99. Had a modem and a keyboard, and you could mod it to play copy games once the local GameStop is forced to close due to undisclosed post-apocalyptic reasons. In short, the Sega Dreamcast was awesome. Again, it had a keyboard, it had a myriad of controllers. It was the perfect home bunker entertainment system. You could even run Linux on it, which is good because installing Linux there would probably make the first few years of the bunker life fly by. And really, nothing cool has happened since. So that's it for your Linux lamentation, coupled with a couple of questionable calculations of complex numbers. And that's that for Barrett time.
Wow.
Yeah, we're good for 2015 now, right?
I don't think you have to do another Barrett time until 2036.
Awesome. There's an ugly 2032 code coming.
There's
a 2032 bug.
I thought it was a 2036 date bug because it was.
It's when C runs out.
Is the 8-bit integer the Unix code bug?
Yeah, the Unix. It's the Unix time epoch overflow as in 2038, isn't it?
I thought it was 2036.
I think it's 2038.
There is a couple. You're 2038.
That's the time epoch.
That's when
overflow.
That's when a signed 32-bit. Memory space will actually run out of days.
It's
to
the
store.
Epoch number.
Yeah, milliseconds since.
So that's why they were going to 32-bit integers. They've been trying to shift them since the Y2K bug.
Yeah,
that's,
I mean, the problem is all the embedded
out
systems and stuff that they can't update, which will be terrifying. Things falling out of the sky. Because you know how big of a deal Y2K was.
Well, we have a bigger thing coming up this year, don't we? Is it the Back to the Future?
Shh. You're not supposed to know. Don't drive your cars at 88 miles per hour. Someone laughed. What's this year's bug?
It's not a bug.
Or what is this year's?
Isn't it the date? Is it 19, when they went to the future? Was it 2015?
Oh, the September.
October, I think, something.
Where will you be when Marty McFly shows up?
October 21st, 2015, Back to the Future Day.
Yeah, that's going
to
be...
And then we get to notice all the things that we don't yet have, like hoverboards.
Well, you know,
we're already working hard on hoverboards, though.
We're already disappointed over the whole flying car thing, so the hoverboards, you know. But that's kids today. You think you're
disappointed. I want my Mr. Fusion.
I need to find a Polaroid camera so I can take a picture of myself and then watch myself slowly vanish.
Slowly vanish. First your mustache goes.
Slowly vanish.
Yeah, Baritime has been slowly vanishing for a while.
It's back. Marty McFly's behind me.
Well, I guess there's the we hadn't really gotten even halfway through all the Apple stuff, and you know, the phone's got cool new stuff. One of the things that looks interesting on the new phone, but not to me, not enough that you'd like rush out and get a new one, is they really are thinking about what to do with the they call it 3D touch now. I guess the force touch thing. Maybe because of Star Wars, maybe they didn't want to talk about force touch. But anyways, they demonstrated some of the stuff, the new things from iOS with force touch, where a light touch on something gives you a preview, which if you're an Apple user, something along the lines of like a quick look, and then the firmer touch launches the actual app with whatever content, you know, it was supposed to have. So they demonstrated like an email where you can just lightly touch the email icon and you see the most recent one, and if you push a little harder then it opens up email and you see that message. So they're coming up with ways to let you, you know, control how you see your information, because sometimes just a quick, you know, you just want to check that email, or you just want to read the latest thing, or you know, some of it, it's beyond sort of a right click concept, and they're trying to make it more useful, useful as an OS thing. Although it still has the kind of stuff like on maps, the force touch thing brings up more information, so it kind of does the right click approach. The other big thing with the new iPhones, the 6S, obviously, you know, there's the faster processor, we talked about that. The LTE and Wi-Fi are supposed to be upgraded. The LTE has been upgraded dramatically and supposedly will support up to 150 megabit LTE connection. So that way it can be even better than a lot of people have at home. It's just their one phone will have a better internet connection than their whole house or their whole business. And now Siri will be always on from the new ones. Before, If you had plugged in, it could be hands-free.
Where Siri's now, taking over.
Siri's on.
Siri, make Pete talk clearly.
I can cover this one for Pete if he's dropping out. So
is that going to affect battery life, though? Or
well, here's the deal. So
a way to power
previously,
up?
Previously.
Is there a hot safe word or keyword or hot word?
There's
or?
the Siri safe word. Well, previously, so your iOS device always has Siri, and if your iOS device was plugged in to a power source, you could hands-free summon Siri by saying, "Hey Siri," and as
three
I say
times
this,
in a mirror,
as I say this, 50 listeners' iPhones all of a sudden pop up and say, "Yes."
So you're saying if your phone is plugged into power and you say, "Hey Siri,"
yeah, you never knew that.
No,
yeah,
hey,
it's
Siri.
Super handy. Because I use that all the time at work. Because when I'm at work at my desk, I've got my iPhone plugged in, and it's really handy just to be like typing and to be able to like ask like, you know, "Hey Siri, what's the weather going to be like tomorrow?" Or for conversions, I'll be, because I have to, like, when we do.
I was
any
unduly
kind of
impressed with the Amazon thing.
No, it's
brought.
Neat. You can be sitting there typing whatever, and your phone can be over here, and you can, like, sort of look over and be like, "Hey Siri, what's 70 degrees Fahrenheit in Celsius?" And she'll tell you without you having to, like, go
you
to
Google.
You
can do OK Google, too.
Well, and that's the thing. Yeah. Like, that's always been the response, is on the Android side, you can do OK Google for phones that support it.
Have you guys finally gotten copy-paste yet?
With, yeah.
Okay, sorry.
With hands-free. And so that's been the big difference. Like, on the Android side, you can say OK Google, and the phone doesn't have to be plugged in if the phone is one of the models that supports that. And then on the iOS side, you can only hands-free summon Siri if the phone is plugged in. Well, that is all changing now. Uh-huh. But it's unclear, and Pete, you may know, but it's unclear from my read whether this is just for the new 6S and 6S Plus devices, or if this is an iOS 9 change that's retroactive across the entire line. Do you know?
It appears to be a 6S and 6S Plus add the option to have Siri listen all the time. So I think it sounds like it's tied specifically to the 6S and 6S Plus, and plus you have to go in and decide if you want to enable it or not.
They must have found like a new low power microphone or a way to do that without draining a lot of battery life, is what my guess would be.
Yeah, you know, that sounds legit.
Yeah. No, the weird thing about saying like "Hey Siri" over the radio is that I've got a couple of Amazon Echoes in my place, and if you mm-hmm. say Alexa, they come to life. And there have been Amazon's really big into streaming commercials about the Alexa when you're doing right. Amazon Prime. So a lot of times they will take control of the Alexas, and all the Alexas will jump to life after seeing an Alexa commercial.
That's terrifying.
Yeah, it's not good. They need to, like, especially if Amazon's doing the commercials, like do some kind of like blocking control signal or do something.
It's kind of like the old joke when Google Glass first came out about how like you wanted to run to Google I/O and run up on stage and just scream, you know, "Okay, Google, show me pictures of butts." And then
sight
like,
filter off.
Looked at her. Somebody at DEF CON was saying loud. Was giving Siri commands or giving Google Glass commands. I don't want to turn Flicked in if that wasn't him, but that seems like something he may do.
It is like a... I forget, how do you start it? You say, "Go Google Glass."
Okay, Glass.
Yeah, it was like, "Okay, Glass, pictures of Goatsy."
Yeah, it was Flicked in. It was
safe filter off.
Actually, I got Barrett to do that at the airport. There was a guy sitting there with Google Glass, and Barrett walked by and said it, and the guy started laughing and said, "Yeah, I don't have them turned on right now."
That's right. Goodbye.
Goats.
So yeah, so you can rush in a frenzy to pre-order the 6S on September 12th, and they will arrive September 25th in more than a dozen countries, including the U.S. and the U.K. I think one of the things that Bear's saying is you need to be, you know, the price when they quote the low end price. And one of the things Apple did that I think is kind of in this current environment, quoting the subsidized price of a phone is kind of a crock.
Sorry, that's what you get when you
Lee's laptop agrees.
It's kind of a crock. So they, you know, for instance, the iPhone 6S Plus, you know, which would be the higher end one, the slides are from $299, which of course that's, you know, not
your Wi-Fi only phone.
That's the 16 gig Wi-Fi only. The real price, if you don't have a contract, if you're doing these other programs that all the cell phone companies are moving towards, it's about $750.
How many dogs is it?
Yeah. 750 dogs are
the
16
this.
Gig, and then it's $100 for each memory step right. up. And you really want to think about it. If you're going for a 6S, which shoots 4K video and those kinds of things, you really need to consider budgeting for more memory.
Well, I notice what they've done. Apple in this particular product refresh has eliminated the 32 gig devices as a category. It goes 16 to 64. And so that almost guarantees that you're gonna pick the 64 gig one and not pick the low end one unless you are really, really sure you need it or you really, really don't know what you're doing. One of the two.
I don't know why they didn't bump that to 32 instead of 16.
Because it keeps their low end margin high and it keeps their low end price low and allows them to have a low number.
That's a little bit deceptive, like them lowering and doing the subsidized price. I mean, that's only going to lead to like other shadiness, like misreporting like gigabits and gigabytes.
Well, but that's like you know, selling a desktop with like half a gig of memory when you know the OS really needs a gig of memory to be functional, except. On this one, you can't upgrade it.
That sounds like something that no computer manufacturer I know would ever do.
Apple had to do it to get in on Windows.
And even having a sticker on it that says that it's certified.
That sounds like something that no laptop OEM I've ever heard of would ever do. No, I agree. It's a little, you know, hinky, but it's just kind of how they're rolling. I mean,
I think we've gotten to the stage. One of the things is, you know, just on the advice phase is you definitely want to go with more memory and consider it that you're probably going to buy this and use it for several years before you replace it. I mean, they're really hitting the point where it's got cool new features and force touch and, you know, shoot 4K and all that kind of stuff. That's great. Unless you really, really have a reason in your profession or something like that. If you've got a 6 and a 6 or a 6 plus, there's not a real reason to trade up. You know, there's not a reason to that. It's not, you're not going to get a lot of value for buying a new one. That's like buying a new computer every year. And so think try and think more in those terms is my suggestion to people if you're looking at this, and make sure you buy a, you know, like Flick had mentioned, you can't upgrade the memory. So make sure you get enough so that it's going to work and so, it'll raise the usefulness of the device.
What was the low-end price point?
The low-end on-contract price for the
purchase outright.
The off-contract unlocked price?
Yeah.
Was $650? I think it was
$650 for the 6S and then $750.
I thought their low-end price used to be $550.
No, I don't think so. Maybe. Remember.
I don't think.
I think it was $650.
I know that what they've done in the past is it's been super difficult, and it'll probably change this time around. It's a moth in this studio. It's been super difficult to get the unlocked off contract devices for the first few months that they're on sale because they allocate more. Apple allocates the entire run to the contract ones because they get more money up front off of them. They get a payback subsibility from the
Although
carriers.
Now, like T-Mobile, there
now
is no such thing as a contract.
So I don't know what the allocation is going to look like this time. It'll be interesting to see if you can. Like, you couldn't go on launch day for a 5S or a 6 and get an off-contract one. You just couldn't. There just weren't any. Hopefully that's going to be different this time.
I don't know how it's going to work, because, like, with T-Mobile, you know, I mean, maybe they're going to tell you you have to have a contract, but at the same time, you could go get it. Say you're on T-Mobile, break your contract the next day, pay T-Mobile the full price, and you're done. You got it.
I don't know how.
And it's unlocked.
It'd be interesting to see. But yeah, get unlocked devices are what you want. You always want to get an unlocked device from here on. Don't let a carrier tell you what to do. Don't let them tell you what to do.
Who keeps joining and leaving ICQ? I hear doors.
Yeah, me too.
It's Pete's dogs. They keep coming in and going out by themselves.
Well,
on the internet.
The conversation that always crops up around these new Apple announcements are the selling of old Apple.
Yes, the repurposing or selling.
So there are, you know, the thing that frustrates me is that there are a number of companies out there that will pay you for your old hardware, your old iPhone. And it aggravates me because, you know, anytime you sell to someone who's going to resell, I mean, they're not buying it because they think your phone's neat and they want to have it and give it to their kids. They have an idea that they're going to resell it. They're going to make a profit off of it.
Right.
And so people get all excited about $200, $300 for their couple-of-year-old iPhone. And I have always just taken mine to the independent market, to the eBay, and sell it there. And I always make way more money than I would ever make.
Anybody want to buy a phone?
I've done the Apple trade-in at the Apple store for used phones before.
That doesn't seem like much, though. How much is that? Just $100 or $200?
Yeah, I got for, when did I do it last? I did it last when I went from a 4 to a 5S, and I'd paid full price for the 4 when it came out, full on contract price. So I'd paid like $200 for it, and I got back, I paid $200 for it up front, I suppose I should say, because I was on contract for 2 years. But on the trade-in, for even though that device was like 2 years old, I got back like $150 for it.
Maybe just Jay's web savvy when it comes to selling stuff, but what kind of percentage have you lost? I mean, you don't lose that much. You
how much?
Well, you can't think of it. You can't think of
you
it as a loss.
You got $150 on a $600 phone
because you've purchased that device. You've gained utility from it throughout the use. It's a sunk
well,
cost.
Well, okay,
I've bought the phone on contract, so I got the contract price, the subsidized price, which is, you know, probably half or less than what it would cost.
A third, probably.
Retail. And I've been able, you know, and then I've used the phone for my, you know, because I wanted to have a phone, I used it.
Yeah, it's actually less than a third. I mean, because usually you're going to pay maybe $200, and the phone's worth $700, $800.
I've historically sold my phone for as much as I paid on the subsidy price or more.
Wow.
Boom. Yeah.
So,
although the flip side may be, if you know you're going to do that kind of thing, you might want to look at these plans where you pay like $10 a month. You know, T-Mobile has the jump plan. They all have a one where you pay and then you can upgrade it, you know, once a year or something.
Well, I know.
And it may actually be cheaper to do that than to buy the phone, do the 2 year contract,
well, and
sell
Apple's, it. Apple's doing one too. And I wanted to talk about that. But first, in the past at least, and maybe with all of the carriers switching away from locked contract pricing, this is going to change. But in the past at least, the opportunity has been there, like Jay's saying, to unload your old phone generally through eBay and stuff to resellers who are not just going to resell it, but generally to resellers who are going to take your device, unlock it, as part of a bulk unlock that they're doing with a bunch of other devices they buy, and then sell them in developing markets to companies or to people who want nice phones that aren't generally available down there, either in South America or like Asia. Some of the, or like developing markets where they don't
have
necessarily, it's very gray markety, but that's generally why, that's generally why you can flip them, because they can be unlocked and resold. And with
flipper fence,
with there being so many, with unlocked phones rapidly becoming the norm in the US at least, I'm wondering how that's going to affect the aftermarket pricing. Cause no, there's no longer that incentive to acquire phones that nobody wants, unlock, flip and resell, because they couldn't be sold in the first place because they were always locked. So I don't know, maybe it's going to change this time around. Jay, you'll have to tell us.
U.S. market was one of the only places that had locked phones.
Yeah, but we would also generally get...
But we would get the iPhones.
I will say that if, you know...
Which were locked.
Unlocked devices sell better than locked devices, obviously.
Barrett, could you give us the 30-second summary of what we're talking about, locked and unlocked devices, because there may be people listening who aren't super familiar with
that
term.
Put me on the spot. I don't use iPhone or anything like that, but generally when someone talks about locked and unlocked, you've got different radios in any given phone. A lot of times the phone that you may get may have functionality. For instance, being able to talk to different networks, being able to communicate on different networks, that the carriers and their bright wisdom say, hey, we're going to lock them out of it. And they can do it at the firmware level. Sometimes they can do it with application stuff. There are a couple different ways to go about it. So what that does is that prohibits you from taking one phone that you get. Usually, it's usually because if you buy a phone at a subsidized price like we talked about, Flicted said it's usually about a third of what you might pay for. So you get a $600 phone for $200. They don't want you to break the contract and go use it somewhere else. They want you to keep paying them. So it's kind of like, you know, like a razor blade, razor kind of solution on that. So when you unlock a phone, there are a couple ways to do it. The iPhone community has always been looking for flaws inside of iOS. They figure out a way to do that. They swap out the bootloader and you load kind of a clean ROM. Same thing with Android. Android makes it a little bit easier just because Android's kind of open source from the beginning. You can get, you know, all the software to compile your own Android programs and even like modify the ROM without having to jump through as many hoops and sign your life away like you do with Apple. So it's two kind of different words, two kind of different worlds. But the idea is that it'd be great if you could buy a single phone and take that wherever you want to go, and it works wherever you want to in the world, and you can take it from carrier to carrier to carrier and not have any issues.
But yeah, they've been locking phones since
forever.
Manufacturers have been making phones that worked on multiple networks.
Ever since GTE MobileNet fractured and into two others, and there were all of a sudden multiple. Yeah. And that's kind of the old norm in the U.S. at least, was if you bought an AT&T phone, it was an AT&T phone.
And the thing was that they didn't necessarily have to be. A lot of times it's cheaper for the manufacturers, the handset manufacturers, to make a board that does everything. But because it's easier to, you know, have to tool for eight different phones and do eight different production runs and have to, like, you know, guess how many of each we should make and the product mix. They would just make the same thing, and then you could make the phones different phones and software.
Well,
so
most,
it might not have been so nefarious, but it's still, they're still keeping us from functionality.
Well, in most phones, eventually you could request to have them unlocked.
Only
like if it was a GSM phone, you could contact the provider. I mean, like the Razors, like Motorola Razors and
you
stuff,
could.
You could get those unlocked. If
I mean, a lot of times that
you could call them and say,
if you got
I'm
a
leaving
customer
the country,
service rep in a good mood.
Well, obviously,
I'm leaving the country, and you can, and they would give you an unlock code, except for the iPhone, which was only on AT&T in the U.S., Apple and iPhone had an agreement that Apple and AT&T had an agreement that they would not unlock an iPhone.
And this
ever
was...
for any reason, forever and ever, amen.
But now
the
they
end.
Just come unlocked. I mean,
well, there's a
from Verizon,
the Google flagship phones, Nexus. You can buy straight.
They finally changed. AT&T finally, like
thanks,
two
Obama.
Or three years ago,
there's,
changed.
There's a law now. Carriers are required to unlock it. If you have a locked device, carriers are required to unlock it when you request. If your account is in good standing and you've paid off the phone subsidy. Now, and I think, we've been talking about, most carriers are going toward unlocked devices in the first place. But I mean, the whole idea was that, yeah, they'd sell you the device on subsidy. They'd sell you the $1,000 phone for $200 with the expectation that you were then locked into a 2-year contract and you would pay more than that $1,000.
That was, yeah. Generally, the thing was, is that in the American market, the mindset of the consumer was, this phone's worth about $150,
$200. Right.
And they didn't tell you in your $80 a month bill, $15 or so of it was a subsidy towards your phone.
Yeah.
And so it was just your monthly bill was $80. And so you'd get this phone and like, oh, it's a $150 phone. And then somebody would say, well, you can buy that phone outright and not be under contract.
Well, how much? That sounds great. $850.
How much is it? That's crazy.
Yeah.
You know, but the thing is, what a lot of times what happened is somebody gets this phone. They get this, you know, phone. They think it's worth $150, $200. They're going through their contract, right? They're making $15 every month off of you without you realizing that's what it's going towards. Within 2 years, they've actually gotten more money than the phone would have been worth if you would have bought it outright. And then your contract's up, and now you're month to month, and you're still paying that $15 a month subsidy for a phone that you've already paid off.
And depending on the carrier and the phone, it was a crapshoot until relatively recently when you were in that post-contract spot where you've gone month to month, and maybe you've got your, you know, prior to the law being changed, maybe you've got your, you know, expensive phone that you've long since paid off your month to month, and you think, yeah, this phone's still pretty great. I want to take it and switch to cheap carrier and, you know, not pay $180 a month. I want to pay $40 a month. And to do that, the phone has to be unlocked and it's up to the carrier. And the carrier says,
no, we want
to. Nah, it's all right. No, we're not going
to
do that.
Yeah, they're kind of afraid that the big secret that no one wants to talk about. There was a time when you could get like the engineering codes like to the old Nokia phones and you could do a lot of fun stuff with the phones. But yeah. I guess when Qualcomm came on and when a lot of these, like the actual radios in the phones, you have to pretty much, I joked around about saying you had to sign your life away to get in bed with Apple to write software for them. But to be able to see like the opcodes and what actually goes in, like to the, for instance,
the
like Qualcomm,
stuff.
The baseband stuff, it's almost impossible, and they will sue you out of existence if you were to peek at those and then in any way divulge them. And a lot of people that have seen them, they've said more or less it's because those stacks are super fragile, and if anyone actually got a hold of them, it would be fairly easy to topple a lot of the cellular phone networks just because there aren't a lot of controls in there. There's a lot of trust between devices. So I do kind of get that, but there needs to be a way to maybe lock the user out of that while still letting them, you know, use their phone as if it were actually their phone. And I want to say, was it Wall Street Journal or someone had a big thing today coming out saying, hey, if you own a device, you should quote unquote own the device and be able to
Wall
service
Street
it.
Journal. Yeah, I think I saw
so that's
that.
Good news for us because that means that there's kind of a groundswell of everyday people that are starting to clue into like, hey, if I buy this, I should be able to do whatever I want to with it and not be arbitrarily locked out from, you know, doing things that void warranties or even worse, get you thrown in jail.
Well, when you've got what you think is a $150 semi-disposable phone that you upgrade every couple of years, you know, I mean, it's not an insignificant amount of money, but to a significant part of the population, it's just like sort of become a background thing that you pay every couple of years, you get paid another $150, buy a new phone. If all of a sudden you're exposed to the true cost of that, and every couple of years you're buying a new $800 phone,
people would slow down.
You start to care a lot more about it, about being able to tinker with it.
Yeah, because I wanted an unlocked iPhone.
Yeah.
And at the time, the only way you could get that, because AT&T would never unlock it ever for you, was to buy it outright at the Apple Store. So I bought an iPhone 4S outright, $750, I think, from the Apple Store.
Weren't you looking at even trying to source one from Canada before you could get them unlocked in the U.S.?
Actually, I was going to get one from Hong Kong.
Hong Kong,
because Hong Kong had a law that all phones sold had to be unlocked. So it was one place where you could get an unlocked iPhone. But I'd also looked into it and seen that, like, in Sweden, or it was a Scandinavian country, somebody said, here's how you go about unlocking your iPhone from your carrier. You go get the iPhone, and after it was 60 or 90 days, you contact them and say, I want my iPhone unlocked. And then they send off a code to Apple, and then you just take your iPhone and you hook it into iTunes.
Yeah.
And then a screen pops up and says, congratulations, your phone has been unlocked.
Correct.
So I called up AT&T and said, hey, I want my phone unlocked. They were like, no, it can't be done. I'm like, no, I know it can be done. I can see they can do it in Sweden, and this is how you do it. And it doesn't have to be done.
And they're like, nah.
It actually comes from Apple, and all you don't even have to enter a code. You just hook your phone into iTunes, and it's all done. It obviously can be done.
Nah, we're not going to do that.
Pretty much, yeah. And they were like, well, we can't do it because Apple won't let us. And so then I tried to contact Apple at some point, and they're like, yeah, we can't do it because AT&T won't let us.
Yeah.
No, it's a lot of finger pointing back and forth.
Well, back to my original point.
We had a point.
When it comes to reselling the phone,
right?
You know, so,
I was say, was your original point about Windows 95?
Yeah, my original point was how to dial up to the internet with a modem. 20 years later, so I was looking there. One of the more, one of the more reputable, quote unquote, reputable places for an iPhone 6 Plus, 16 gig base model. Their offers $398. Now that's going to seem like $200 more than what you paid for the contract price, you know, a year ago. But looking on eBay, and I've discovered something else interesting on eBay. Mm-hmm. Looking on eBay, looks like they're going for a little over $500, you know.
Oh, my gosh.
On the retail market.
Wow.
There's also appears to be another thing going on eBay, which is very funny, because if you want to go look at closed auctions on eBay to see what something sells for, you will see completed auctions with, I mean, there are auctions that they put something up for sale and it doesn't meet the reserve or it doesn't sell or nobody bids on it. And then there's completed auctions, which show you how much the final bid was. And iPhone 6 Pluses are maxing out right now for about $8,000 to $10,000 a pop for a phone. But that's not actually real. If you go and look at the bid history on it, there's apparently this must be an eBay trolling thing, because people are going in with zero feedback, new accounts, and bidding these things up to, like, you know, so somebody goes on to eBay and wants to sell their phone.
Mm-hmm.
The actual, what looked to be legitimate bids for an iPhone 6 Plus 128 gig unlocked, sell, you know, looks like the last legitimate bid was around $750. And then somebody came along with zero feedback and bid it up to $10,000.
That's a good way to launder
that's
money.
A lot of that time, that's what that is. I've seen some really ridiculous things going for, like, you know, like around that figure. Usually it's like right under 6,000 or whatever the IRS kind of thing is that raises suspicion of things after report. Is it 10 now?
It's 10,000.
Okay, yeah. But a lot of those things, it's like, why would that happen? And someone actually closed, the money went through. But I'm like, okay, that's obviously they're moving money through PayPal is what they're doing.
Well, and PayPal has extremely strict reporting stuff. I mean, I don't know why you would try to do that with PayPal.
Don't die.
Don't die, Lee.
So this is while Lee resuscitates himself. Yeah, so I saw somewhere, I don't know if it was New York cops, but somewhere someone's making a dongle that's like a little bitty Wi-Fi dongle. And it does kind of some of the same stuff that the equipment does that we brought out to the Geek Gatherings, in that it sniffs wireless traffic, and it captures the MAC addresses on the Wi-Fi radios on phones and laptops and things around them. And then it looks up those MAC addresses against a database of stolen phone and laptop MAC addresses. And that way, if they get within, you know, like, you know, call it, you know, 10 yards, 20 yards of a stolen device, they might know. Now, tracking that down, they're going to have some directional stuff. But that's kind of cool, because this is the first time, you know, Jay Lee mentions, you know, the high price of phones and things like that. This is one of the first times where people are actually not ignoring the fact that, you know, iPhone, iPad, laptop theft is so rampant, especially on the phone side.
Right.
In cities like New York and, you know, outside the U.S., you know, that's one of the main things that are stolen. So maybe this, I don't know if it'll deter it, but at least there's a way to start to recover it without you having to be vigilante. You know,
well, Apple's actually
something.
Also taken a couple steps in the last 2 or 3 years with their software and the way you access the phone and rewipe the phone, like wipe the phone and reload the OS and stuff that makes it.
Well, they do. I don't make it difficult.
If you found a phone on the street, though, they don't. They make it where you can wipe your personal data from a lost phone, but they don't necessarily lock someone out of finding a quote unquote.
They'll do IMEI blacklisting on request. If you report your phone stolen to Apple, they'll blacklist your IMEI, so the unique device identifier in the phone.
But
sort
let's
of like
say
the Mac address.
You actually do find a phone. And
like you're walking down the street.
You find a phone.
There it is.
There's a phone. I pick it up, and there's no way for me to figure out who owns it. And can I take that phone and get a SIM card and put it in there and use it?
You can spoof the IMEI pretty easily.
No, but what's that?
Yeah.
But
I think it depends. If they've put a code to unlock the phone in.
If they put a code to unlock the phone in, you just enter the wrong code 10 times, and it wipes the phone. Then you've got a free blank phone.
But unless the phone's been reported stolen or somebody's there, then I could go down and go to Verizon and get a SIM card. Or that's also the same thing that allows you to pass phones on. You can sell your phone to someone else so they can use it.
Yeah. Unless it's been reported stolen and IMEI blacklisted. And then, I mean, even
that's
though
tricky
you can
too,
spoof
cause you
it,
could scam people with that. You could actually, you know, like sell your phone and then be like, hi, I reported it stolen. Give me my phone back. And then, you know, and then rinse and repeat.
Oh, that would be.
It just
bad.
Seems like, I don't know. That's,
you know, one
that's
of the times that you that show up to the Walmart parking lot to do that sale, you're going to get the same guy again, and he's going to shoot you.
Well, I think that IMEI blacklist is a permanent thing. I think once your phone's on that list, your phone's done.
No fly list of iPhones.
Yes, it says you do not get off the IMEI blacklist. And I was going to say, it's kind of a chicken and egg problem to spoof it, too, because you've got a, I think...
Well, you'd have to find a clean IMEI number that they would know about, I would assume. Or find one
works,
of a dead phone. It's like buying birth certificates off the dark web.
It's enough of a pain to where, why don't you just go buy a new phone?
Yeah.
It's like,
well, some people, that's the big thing is, you know, without having to go to payphones or radio or whatever, a lot of people, in a, you know, like hackery types or mafia types or whatever, they're always in search of ways to communicate without leaving a trace that they've communicated. You know, and that's where you get into the phone spoofing and this whole thing.
Do they carry their, if they carry a cell phone, do they carry it in one of those little like Faraday baggies so that it
doesn't
radiate?
They make really nice cases now. They're just kind of heavy.
There's an IMEI data database where you can see if your phone has been
blacklisted.
Yeah, I've looked that up before.
Is your phone blacklisted?
No. Nope.
Because of something you did?
Nope. It could be, but it's not.
Yes, I would like to buy that phone for $20, but first let me check this database.
I'm kidding.
Afflicted nons, yes.
Mm-hmm. So there was one more thing, and Peter, maybe you can speak to it. It was this almost like a phone ownership subscription model that Apple announced, so that if you want to like pay, instead of paying $700 or whatever, you could pay like $40 a month and get a new phone next year. Would they, can you,
that's what? Not Apple, that's I know,
is that,
that
a
like
lease?
Verizon does that.
No, Apple now does.
Oh,
it.
Oh, they do.
Yeah, we can get you into a nice new i7. Just come on in.
If Pete doesn't have it handy, just a second, I'll look it up.
That one I didn't see. I didn't find that in the articles that I was looking at.
But... I know that they announced it. Babble, babble, fill.
Is that Apple buyback, or it's a trade-in program? Or
yeah, it was a trade-in. All right, hold on. Got to click like 9 different links here.
It's an interesting market for Apple to get into.
Well, I think they may have gotten tired of... Only being able to sell the full price phone,
well,
you know,
say,
with a full price purchase.
That way they're also either getting old phones off the market from being resold and or just reselling them themselves, so they're making double profit that way.
Yeah, it's called the iPhone Upgrade Program, and it's an Apple retail offering. It's not a carrier offering. But yeah, you get a new iPhone each year. You get to pick your carrier, and the pricing is variable. It starts at about $30 a month, and it includes AppleCare. So if you're of the kind of person who wants to get a new phone every single year and you want to stay on the upgrade treadmill, I guess it's kind of like getting into like the lease a car every 2 years treadmill. If you're that kind of person, you always want a new car. And you always want a new phone too. This is like a program that you might be interested in. The cost works out
this
favorably. It's for an iPhone 6S Plus. Starts at $30 a month.
But that's the 16 gig?
Yeah, it's the 16 gig. I don't see the pricing for the other one in here, but I'm looking at the live blog summary. But yeah, if you want new phone every year, they now have an Apple option instead of getting in with one of the carriers and signing
up. But that's,
something
I mean,
for
that's
them.
Not horrible, because it's like about half the price of the phone. It's 360 versus,
yeah, it works out. And I'm assuming they have some kind of bailout price. So if you're like getting close and you're like, no, I'd like to keep this phone, you can just buy it out instead of having to get the new one. But yeah, it works out. They get good money. They get a usable phone. In theory, they get a usable phone they can resell, and you get your new phone next time, and everybody's happy, and you don't have to sign something with a carrier.
You don't have to do it trying to sell it yourself.
I'm just going to run a Pine Tree Airfresher on my existing phone and go for 2 years.
Well, and so, yeah, so that's all just the phone stuff. Then there was the, it was almost an afterthought for Apple. There's an iPad Mini 4.
Yeah.
They announced too. It doesn't take that much time to talk about, because essentially what it is if you wondered how come the iPad Mini 3 didn't have the same specs as the iPad Air 2, well, now the iPad Mini 4 does. So they basically matched it up. Before, I think that Apple was worried about cannibalizing, you know, having a problem with the iPhone 6S or 6 Plus, the bigger screen phone. They didn't want to have conflict between the phone with the big screen and the small iPad screen, so they kind of kept that lower spec to try, I think, to push people towards the 6 Plus. And now that size is established with the phones, they've kind of gone back to the normal plan, which is The iPad Mini 4 has the specs of the iPad Air 2. And in the smaller size with the Mini, it's got the Retina display and all that kind of stuff and the better processor and so on and so on. So, it's another option. I have an iPad Mini 2 that I got as a deal, that I got off of, one of those. It's a reseller that's on eBay, but they're basically, it's not auctions. They sell it for a fixed price. And frankly, it was with LTE and 64 gigs on it, it was $100 less than an iPad Mini 3 except that was the low end 16 gig crummy iPad Mini 3 versus a 64 gig LTE iPad Mini 2. But I like carrying it around. I like having the LTE, and it's saved my bacon a few times with being able to share out the internet connection.
Not to be all Windows in an Apple world in a full Apple room, but have you heard anything about like the 4K monitors, or I guess like laptop screens, or anything that is thin enough to compete with a MacBook Pro that's kind of new? Or does Apple just dominate everything right now as far as thin laptops with decent displays?
There's a new Toshiba that I've heard that's very competitive for people who aren't Apple focused. I'm trying to remember what the model is. It's recent. It was just, that was sort of the only thing that the only big feature it had. It didn't have any much else that was exciting, but it was very thin. It's got a MacBook Air type enclosure and a 4K display. Let's see if I can find it.
Yeah,
very
it looks
quickly.
Like a convertible 4K laptop, maybe.
Let's see.
Maybe.
Well, it's hard to say. My go-to used to be Lenovo, but after all the Superfish stuff, I'm done with that.
Well, they do have, I'm not seeing the one. Yeah, maybe this. There's one that Toshiba has that's a 4K touchscreen.
That's the one. Yeah, the Toshiba Satellite Radius 12.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know if that's the newest one or if there was another one that I saw, but if you look at it, it's fairly impressive, and you can flip the screen all the way back and use it like a tablet, it looks like.
Did you see the one surprise announcement that came out that sort of they squeaked out when no one was really looking?
Toshiba or Apple?
Apple. Apple's little surprise
back
announcement.
To Apple.
The new Apple Watch models?
No. The surprise announcement was a formalized release date for the new version of OS X.
Which is going to be
called
El Capitan. Formalized release date for El Capitan.
Are we getting into the geography now? Are we done with cats?
It's been announced that for... No, the formalized
third,
release date
third
is September
geography.
September 30th.
Yeah, geography.
Maverick, Yosemite,
yeah, I know.
El Capitan.
No, it's... Denial. So their naming scheme shifted from cats to
mountains.
Important locations
in
California.
Well, yeah.
Because the first one was Mavericks, which is a surfing location that nobody... Beach. Got except for like 12 people in California.
Talk to me, Goose.
And then Yosemite. And the idea with El Capitan is that it's sort of an improved version of the one that came before. So sort of like Leopard went to Snow Leopard with El Cap. It's like El Cap is a mountain in Yosemite. So it's sort of like that kind of like focus. I don't know, whatever. But yeah, September 30th is the release date that was announced today finally. So in a couple of weeks, we'll all be installing El Capitan on our new Apple hardware that we've all got, and we'll all be excited
about
it.
They also announced that they're quadrupling the price, so since it's zero,
it's an irrational number, Pete.
Another free upgrade. Yeah, if don't divide by zero, that's how you create small black holes.
Actually, we have Fun Drive coming up, and if you give on the Fun Drive and you're an Apple user, you can download El Capitan for free at the end of September.
Ooh, I see what you did there.
But they also, let's see, so they did announce, although I guess it wasn't the El Capitan sneak out thing, but Apple Watch OS 2 is coming on September 16th, which dramatically increases the capabilities of third-party apps. Apparently they're opening up access to more of the features of the watch to third-party app developers. They still haven't gotten to where they let third parties design screens for the watch. They also, it sounds like there's going to be, there was some hardware changes And, you know, watchOS 2 is for people who kind of already have the Apple Watch or are already planning to get one. You know, the article I found is on Ars Technica, basically ended with saying, you know, that their advice had been in the first place that most people should wait until the operating system, watch operating system and app ecosystem had some time to mature, and that that you should still probably wait for second generation hardware if you can, but that watchOS 2 is at least a big improvement for the watches. So there's that. And Apple TV.
Yes, Apple TV. They are finally doing something with this thing I See, talked about.
This is what I've been waiting the whole show for.
Really?
I just wanted to hear what happened with it.
Oh, yeah, there's a new
with thing. Apple TV.
Well, you know, I had talked a while back about having a device that was smart enough to, like, search through all the different streaming providers to find the content
okay,
that you
Okay, this
wanted.
Actually was pretty cool. Yeah, I know
so,
where you're going.
So now the new Apple TV, which is voice activated, which you don't actually have to yell at the TV, you talk to the remote.
Right, yeah.
Which I thought was just a really clever bit of kit there, because most of the, like the Xbox and other devices, you kind of have to yell at across the room at them to get them to activate.
Alexa!
Is the
Alexa,
new Apple,
hey!
Is the new Apple remote a microphone?
Huh?
Is the new Apple remote
a microphone?
It is a microphone in the remote.
Someone needs to make like a 3D printed
microphone. So it's like a magic mic.
It's like XXL.
I see what you did there.
And it's got, they showed off functionality. It was actually really neat. It was almost like they asked my wife what she wanted out of a TV solution, because
right.
You can be like, hey, I think you have to call it Siri. I don't remember if you call it Siri or not, but you can basically be like, hey, Apple TV, find me that one episode of that show I like that had that one guy in it from that other show. And it like will do it. It was amazing.
Yeah, I mean, it will patrol, it searches all the different content providers. And I think that's the thing that for cord cutting that has to happen where
yep.
you have one mm-hmm. box and you don't have to flip through all your, hopefully.
Just having to know where to go.
So it's,
well,
it's
you know, I'm going to go, okay, you could, right now you can turn on your Roku or your Apple TV or whatever, and you can flip over to the different streaming services. You can go to Amazon or Netflix or Hulu or whatever.
Yeah, it's just potluck.
And yeah, and you search in there and see if you're going to find what you're looking for. But now having a device where you can actually search all of those for the program, if it works, that is going to be cool. That's going to be the cord cutter's dream, because mm-hmm. you don't have to think about which service has what shows. I have to sit yep. down as it is now and think, is Orange Is the New Black on Hulu or is it
Netflix
or whatever?
Right.
I know where it
no,
is.
No, I'm kidding. I'm helping.
Just an example.
But, you know, to give you so unless you know where to look for your streaming content, you have to flip through all these different services. And my wife is like the beta tester for any of this. So if this can make it where Cynthia can use streaming media player with any, you know, capability.
Ease
or
of use.
Yeah, it will... It will revolutionize the whole streaming media. Cut the cable.
So the size is a little larger, more rectangular.
Yeah, it's a little bit taller. The box is, I think, about the same size square, but it's yeah. a little thicker.
Okay, and
it's
then
not
the price point went up, right? They were saying it might be $200 to $250.
There's a 32 gig model that goes for about $150. A 64 gig model that'll be around $200, and the thing is that now
for
Apple TV,
what's the memory
you can
used
install
for?
Apps. You know, the so Apple would do it, and it was essentially kind of part of the OS.
It's DVR.
No, listen. So there is a stipulation that went around on Twitter from the TV. They're calling it TVOS, is the iOS fork or whatever that runs on this thing. There was a stipulation saying that even though it does have apps now, that there is absolutely no local storage allotted to app usage. So your apps, if they're going to have any local storage, have to be iCloud aware. And the maximum app size is 200 megabytes. Any apps that are larger than 200 megabytes have to use Apple's new on-demand cloud, like application library load and unload thing that they're
so
doing.
What's the storage for?
I didn't think it had local storage. If it has local storage, it's going to be for like storing the iTunes downloads that you download. Like, because remember, iTunes still has like movies and stuff in it too that nobody uses anymore. But you can, I think, buy and download movies there and do that locally instead of streaming. They still have that option.
Now, if the The one thing I don't think it does is it doesn't do like broadcast content.
So no.
It won't search that.
No.
And it won't DVR. As far as I know, it won't DVR.
I don't think it'll DVR.
But if Apple turns their attention towards this concept, it could be very revolutionary.
Especially if they can tie it into phones and tablets. I mean, that's where I see it going. So everything else being equal, if I'm already in the Apple ecosystem, I would want something that would talk to, you know, seamlessly to my phones to, you know, tie it into that somehow.
So everybody was saying the price point they thought was going to be $2 to $2.50. So if it comes in at $150, that's less than
I hadn't heard $2 to $2.50. I had heard that $150 or $200, and then it turns out it was both.
Yeah, maybe that was it. It was $150 to $200, not $200 to $250.
How much was the original Apple TV? Was that
$199? It was $99, and they dropped it to $70, I think. Yeah.
I thought it was more than $99 when they started, and they dropped it to $99.
Nobody was paying attention when it started because they didn't care.
I had one.
Yeah.
Did you? I had one of the big.
I still
Mac
have
Mini
one. I still have
ones.
One of those. Yeah, I still have one.
With the Pentium M that was so slow.
I bought it really used on eBay though because I wanted to hack it to install XMBC Boxy.
That's
on it.
What I did. Except I put Plex on it.
And now I want it. I want a device that connects to everything. Cable, streaming, whatever. Then you talk to it and you say, "I want to watch the channel. I want to watch ABC News, or something like that," and have it say, "Okay, well, it's not on yet. It'll be on in 30 minutes. I'll flip over to that when you're ready. When it comes on for the live broadcast, that would be awesome."
Well, and perversely, a lot of the content providers are disincentivized from having that kind of universal app-like sameness because it. That kind of homogeneity, or whatever you say that word,
homogeneity,
all that kind of sameness makes it so that they can't differentiate themselves.
Right.
If you see a unified interface, you no longer have to care that Hulu might be better than Netflix or vice versa. And realistically,
as a consumer,
we don't care.
But there would be more incentive to sign up for all the services so that you could have this vast swath of content.
Yes, but it still commoditizes the content provider. And if you're the content provider, you don't want that. You spent big bucks on all that brand.
Plus, there's already so many laws about agreements about areas, the coverage, and all that stuff.
Thing,
it's horrible to even try to get them beyond that.
Yeah, man.
It's terrible. Just subscribed to Torrent Vision.
A moment of silence for Aereo.
Oh, poor Aereo. We hardly knew ye.
All right. Well, I know that the Apple TV is probably the most exciting thing out of this batch of announcements, if it turns out to be as cool as it looks.
Would you have believed 20 years ago that we'd have an entire show of Technology Bites dedicated to discussing nothing but Apple products?
Apple, all the time.
Well, you know, it's cool to see stuff happening. And like, I was thinking about it. I know we got to get out of here. But I know leading up to this announcement from Apple, it's like these press conferences have gotten a little tedious. It's a phone, it's a tablet, it's an iMac, it's a MacBook.
It's a watch.
So not to the, in the one today with the Apple TV and just seeing a little glimmer of, like, you know, if they turn their guns on that, it could be the next big thing.
Yeah.
I think the iPad Pro is another one to keep an eye on, even though none of us is going to rush right out and buy one immediately.
Time will tell.
All right. Well, you've been listening to Technology Bites. We're glad you tuned in. Next week is fundraiser, so be ready.
Actually, next week we're not. It's right out. It's Thursday is when it starts.
Really?
Oh, okay.
You sure?
I believe. Yeah, 17.
We still have three of them.
But we probably won't discuss Apple as much next week.
Probably not. We'll talk. We'll have a 10-minute show about Dell. All right.
Give us a head start and drop something in the tip bucket
right.
for us.
Thanks for tuning in. We'll see you next week. I'm Jay Lee.
I'm Peter Hughes.
Inflicted.
I'm Barrett.
I'm Lee.
And he's
Roofhouse.
Hi, this is Natalie, supervisor for this year's KPFT station board election. Listener members like you will be choosing 9 new board members next month. Here are a couple of candidates looking for you to vote them onto the board of KPFT.
Hi, my name is Jerry or Gerard Lynch. As a longtime political activist since the 1960s in the Vietnam War, I have been a listener of KPFT for over 30 years. A proud listener. However, I am concerned. I keep hearing rumors of major financial problems and constant bickering and fighting on the station board. As a newcomer to the KPFT board, I believe I could help with both these problems. I have had a law office devoted to immigration and Social Security disability law for 30 years. Just like I can't help my clients if I don't take care of business at the office, I feel that KPFT will not be able to accomplish the tremendous goals that we hope to accomplish if KPFT does not take care of business. Vote for me, Gerard Jerry Lynch, the KPFT board.
To hear all the candidate statements and read their plans to help KPFT, please visit elections.pacifica.org, click on the station tab, and scroll down to find the official election page for your KPFT Houston station.
Oh, it's Saturday.
Hello, my friends. This is Rick Izquierdo, yes, along with Cleotis Saturday. And Buck. Welcome you to tune in every Saturday on KPFT 90.1 FM at 9 o'clock until noon for the Lone Star Jukebox. Roots rock, Americana, country music at its best. Great interviews, and we always have some great giveaways. Join us every Saturday to kick off your weekend on the Lone Star Jukebox at 9 and noon on KPFT 90.1 FM Pacifica Radio. Who cares?